Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drumroll please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello, all you theater lovers out there, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome to a special episode of Broadway Breakdown, a podcast dedicated to the history and legacy of musical theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. I hope you enjoyed that little retro music intro from our episodes of Yore. With me today is a friend of the pod and our resident movie musical critic. My mother, Tanny Ticton-Koblick. Hi, Mom.
Hey, Matt. Good evening.
Good evening. So this wasn't necessarily part of the plan, but I realized that in the last 12 months... Ooh, sorry, I just burped. In the last 12 months, any time that there's been a movie musical out, we've watched it, and you've come on to discuss it. The Prom, back in December... It didn't come out, but we did an episode about all the Annie movies. And then there's one that came out this week that we are going to discuss. Which is it?
In the Heights.
In the Heights. Now, we have some history with this movie, but you don't really have any history with this show. Yes? You never saw the show?
I never saw the show.
No. But you were aware of it.
I was always aware of it, yes.
Always aware of it. So, I had seen the show. Do you remember... when I was part of that, like, teen critics, like, class in high school, I don't remember. It was, like, some theater organization. They did, like, a writing class for, like, teens to go see shows, and then they would write little reviews about them.
Vaguely.
Yeah. And we went to an event where I, like, gave a speech. Do you remember that?
No. Was I there?
Maybe. I gave a speech. My opening statement was, there's no such thing as a bad theater experience. Let me rephrase. There is such a thing as bad theater, but every experience is worthwhile in terms of building your taste and your knowledge and expanding everything. Anywho.
Particularly now, we're trying to encourage everyone to have the live experience when it becomes available.
Exactly. But yeah. That's to say, we saw In the Heights in that group when it was off Broadway, and then when it moved to Broadway a year later, I went and saw it on the Broadway. But that was my main experience. Then I think I saw one or two... regional production since then. But we have actually I am trying to think of the best way to now word this. The movie came out this past weekend. That was not the first time either one of us had seen the movie, though.
Correct.
Yes. I was gifted a screener about 5 or 6 weeks ago, which I watched by myself. And then 2 weeks later, you wanted to watch it, so we watched it together. And then 3 weeks later, the movie came out, and we watched it on a big screen, although separately. Both correct. On an IMAX screen, around the same time of day, just two different movie theaters.
Correct.
Yes. Although you were sitting next to my friends. So,
I was.
Yes.
Quite by chance.
World is small.
Yeah.
So, here's how I think we're going to go about doing this. There are certain things about this movie that I do not want to discuss, because I don't think it's necessarily our place. Accurate representation of the Latinx community, I don't think that's our place to discuss. There was some controversy when the movie came out about somewhat of erasure of Afro-Latinx people, that the movie was mostly about a specific kind of Latin community, and that the Afro-Latinx community was basically shut out of it. I will say, I will come back to it at a point when we discuss the movie in terms of plot changes, just because there is something in the stage show that does kind of address that, and they cut it, so that was kind of, but well, my opinion on that is more on dramatic structure rather than on representation. So we are both white people, white Jewish people, one might say. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. So not our place to discuss accuracy of representation or to have any kind of, we can have our opinions, but we don't need to voice our opinions on, I don't know, certain, about sounds, about people, about looks, or things like that. You know what I mean?
Like certain lived experience that we just haven't had.
Exactly. So we are going to be discussing the movie from as much of an objective standpoint as we can, discussing it purely as a piece of movie making.
Correct.
That is That's how fine. I would like to do it.
Yep.
So moving on. What were your initial thoughts of the movie, both your first and second time?
First time, as you know, I turn to you at the end and I cry at pet food commercials practically. Mm-hmm. And I said my eyes were dry.
Yeah.
It just didn't move me. Maybe I didn't get it. I didn't have an attachment to the stage show. So I was left a little cold. But I saw it again yesterday and had quite a different experience. Now, I think that it plays very differently, small screen to big screen.
Of course.
And it was much more, well, I saw it in IMAX, so it felt very almost like 3D. It was, mm-hmm. Am I doing okay?
No, you're doing great. I was making sure that it was still recording, that the charging was good. Keep talking.
Well, please. It was a much more face level kind of viewing. You know, everything was big. You felt like you were right in there, right?
You're
on
more
the block.
Immersed in it, yeah.
It's a much more immersed experience. Thank you. Yes. And what I concluded was, and you agree, maybe you don't, is that I didn't have expectations the first time. But the second time, I went in a little bit loaded for bear, but I bought in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing, you have to just sort of buy into it, because it explodes almost like Radio City Music Hall at Christmas time. It's that active, that big, that loud. But when you can sort of see it almost face to face, it's a different experience. In the heights, I hang my flag upon display. It reminds me that I came from miles away. We came from miles away. My life is more expensive every day. Every day. And tonight is so far away. But as for
manana, mi bana, you gotta. It's a tricky situation for me, because there are some movies of yesteryear where you really can't watch it on a computer screen, because in the before time, and when I say before time, I mean like pre-1970, really, where movies were filmed with the understanding of you're going to see this on a big screen. Part of the photography of this is about seeing it on a big screen. That's like why Lawrence of Arabia was the movie it was, or Dr. Zhivago, or Gone with the Wind. They were these epics that you only saw on a big screen, and it wasn't until, I guess, the mid-50s when movies started playing reruns on TV that was started to become a thing. But even then, like, movies were not being made with the mind frame of, oh, will this play on like a TV screen at some point? I would say starting from the 1980s onwards, when home video became a thing, and then especially in the 2000s, once we had the streaming boom, movie makers now have to be keenly aware of how a movie's going to play on a small screen. And I think it's kind of the ultimate test of whether your movie holds up or not these days anyway. Whoop, I just hit my mic. How it holds up these days anyway. If it can still play well on a computer screen, maybe not as well as on a big screen, but still, you know, hold its own.
It's like when you design a website, it has to work on your phone.
Yeah.
Right? Same kind of thing.
Well, so Mike Bello, friend of the pod, who will be a future guest on the next series for this pod, he always likes to say the true test of a musical, if it's good or not, is it should make just as much sense and work just as well in a black box as it does in an elaborate setting. Mm-hmm. which is absolutely fair. I think sometimes there are shows where the elaborate staging can help enhance the musical, help enhance the storytelling. But yeah, like if it's a strong musical, if the bones are there, it should be able to work as stripped down as possible, as well as done up to the nines. I've always enjoyed the stage show of In the Heights. I've never found the stage show to be exceptional writing, because I don't have an emotional connection to that world necessarily. In the same way that, you know, I can never tell anyone if the play Significant Other is good, because I'm so in it, like my everything about me is in that play, that I have absolutely no objectivity. I just black out and start crying the moment it begins. So it's going to be like 40 years so I can tell you if Significant Other is any good. But within the Heights, because I'm not, that's not really my world, those are not the people that I grew up knowing, I don't have that emotional connection to it. So I always have viewed it more objectively, and I always found it to be this amazing score and a kind of okay script. And to be fair, some friends of mine who have worked on the show, both Broadway and on tour, when I tell them this, they go, yeah, kind of true.
Well, you know what? I'm gonna encourage you to watch it one more time, because the fact that we can't access that particular experience isn't enough of an excuse. I mean, for example, you know, Fiddler on the Roof playing in Japan. Mm-hmm. There are certain universals that mm-hmm. come out in a movie like this. It's still about people. It's still about love. It's still about family. It's still about displacement. So many people are displaced. It's just there are certain common things.
I think that a musical or any work, any dramatic work, can be universal. It doesn't necessarily have to be people you know. So I think The Fiddler is a brilliant example of that, where it's a show that hundreds of millions of people around the world connect to, even if they are not Jews from Russia, or just Jewish in general. We talked about that before, I think, in Japan, when Fiddler premiered in Japan, it mm-hmm. like was this huge explosion, and everyone there was like, do Americans get this show? Because they connected so much to the tradition and the family structure, power dynamics of the genders. It was really kind of potent to them. What I always connected with In the Heights was the sense of community and family. I always felt that the show was trying so hard to be such a positive representation of the Latinx community that it always felt a little squeaky clean, and thus there wasn't a lot of edge or drama mm-hmm. to it, mm-hmm. which is fine. It doesn't have to be that. No work can cover absolutely everything. It was what I'm saying is that was a choice that they made that I understood. It was not always my tempo, but my bringing this up about the show is I'm trying to explain how I got to the movie, which is mm-hmm. that I got to the movie fully on board with, you know, the show is not sacred to me. If any changes are made, bring it on. I think some of the best movie musicals have had major changes done to them. I've talked about it before. Oliver has some major script changes that improve the material so much. It is the most mediocre stage show that's turned into the most brilliant film. The Sound of Music does song placement differently in the movie than they do in the stage show, and they cut stuff. West Side Story does that too. So I'm not precious about it. The first time I watched the movie, I thought it was only kind of just okay. There were a lot of things I didn't really care for it. The second time I saw it with you 2 weeks later, I liked it more. And then the third time on the IMAX screen, I cannot say that I loved it overall. I still like it. I think it's a good movie. And I think there are moments of it that are exceptional. But there are also moments of it that I find kind of sloppy. And we'll get into all this in a bit. What sort of threw me was having seen it the first two times on my own and then with you, it was before any reviews came out or anyone was really talking about the movie much. And I was like, I wonder what everyone's going to think of this. Like, it's kind of a little too long. Some of the numbers are kind of a little overblown, and not all the scenes are that interesting, and some of the plot lines get dragged on for too much. But then all the reviews were coming out, and everybody was going online about it, and people who I have seen, like, destroy what I think to be, like, very well-crafted films were like, oh, this movie is perfect. This movie is a masterpiece. And I was very thrown, because I think you can like this movie. I like this movie. The word perfect is such an objective term. No emotion can be put on it. What you're saying
subjective,
is that...
Subjective, no?
No. Perfect cannot be subjective, because perfect is literally saying that it is free of criticism, right? I think people are using the word in a subjective way, and that is incorrect. For example, when I say that Paddington 2 is perfect, and we've watched Paddington 2 recently, when I say that Paddington 2 is perfect, I'm not telling you it's the best movie ever made. I love it. You don't have to like it. I don't want to know you if you're someone who doesn't like Paddington 2, but Liz, I'm gay. When I say it's perfect, I mean, like, there's literally nothing I can critique about it. And I don't think there's anything anyone can critique about it, because you cannot like what it's trying to do, but what it does, it succeeds at doing everything it's trying to do in terms of storytelling, aesthetic, pacing. There's not a wasted second. There's not a wasted frame. Every acting choice makes sense within the characters, within the worlds. There's no inconsistencies. Maybe, like, there's some continuity errors, but, like, I've yet to see a single movie that doesn't have that. So when people call this movie perfect, I was like, you can like this movie. This movie is objectively not perfect. There are flaws with it. And I think what happened is, and I'm going to remind people every 5 minutes that I did actually really like this movie, because I'm going to be pointing out criticisms I have with it. And I just want to always remind people, I did like it. I did like it. I liked it more than The Prom, for sure. But I think, and this is going to sound a little tasteless, but I think it's true. I think COVID is the best thing that ever happened to this movie in terms of public perception of it, because after a year, a little over a year of quarantine and lockdown, and then things slowly reopening, and it's all social distancing and masks, to have a big, bold movie musical come out that's all about positivity and community and acceptance and family and love, and just be this celebration of music and dance, is just sort of like the right movie at the right time, which I don't think it would have been a year ago if COVID had never happened. It gave us all sort of a hunger for this kind of film.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. And I also think the fact that it's such an unapologetic musical, which so many movie musicals of late aren't, I know theater people are really pleased to have that, to have a movie musical that's so unabashed with that. So that's my take on other people's reviews on it. And I don't want to speak for everyone, obviously. I know I hate it when people try to, like, psychoanalyze why I have my opinion on a piece of work. So I'm not trying to psychoanalyze everyone. I'm just discussing a pattern that I've been seeing, literally just, like, standing on the sidelines, like, watching the whole picture. And I think how the quality of the movie won't be really determined for a while. I think it's going to take some time for sort of the dust to settle before everyone can kind of look at it again and go, okay, this is the movie. Because every movie musical, when it comes out, there's usually a lot of hoopla about it. Love, hate. And then it's like 5 years later when it's like, oh, this is the general consensus on this movie musical.
Well, so there's nothing else in that space right now, right? There's no combating, competing film.
Not yet,
but right now, I'm saying.
I don't know if you noticed, but there was no teaser for West Side Story. It's almost as if the studio said, we don't want anyone being reminded of another movie musical coming out later this year with Latinx characters that happens to be made by an Oscar-winning director and adapted by a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. Don't think about that movie. Think about this one. Mm. The only movie musical trailer we had was the Dear Evan Hansen trailer.
Yeah.
Which, side note, I think they might have done some retouches on it because Ben Platt looks a little less alien-like in it. Just my 2 cents. So the movie. What are some standout moments in the movie for you?
Standout moments. Well, I think the big swimming pool number was very impressive.
96,000. Yes.
Yes, and I also liked the one in the courtyard at the end.
Carnaval de Barrio.
That one, I liked that a lot. That had a lot of life, and it was so. I don't want to say honest, that's not the right word, but
genuine.
It was genuine, but it was also uncamouflaged because there were big sweat stains on people's clothing, so it was hot where they were. And to me, that was just very real. You know, you don't paint those things on. Those were real.
Yeah. It's I do like that the movie does not glamorize, like, the summer.
Right.
Summer in New York. They're not like, what a gorgeous... And that's part of the show. The show, too, is all about, like, just how fucking hot New York can be in June and July. Like, no one looks cute in the summer in New York City. I also like that the movie cast a lot of different sizes.
Yes.
For all the different roles and totally. Ensemble members, which I love because Broadway is sizist and does not know how to accommodate ensemble members who are not six-pack.
Well, you
members.
Saw it in the ensemble. The stars are pretty pretty, you know? The two yes, women the, are the, very
the,
pretty. Yes,
the four main characters, the love interests in this movie, are all models, very much so. And I'll get into Vanessa and Nina in a second, the actresses, who both of whom I thought did a lovely job. But I learned something about myself on my third viewing because I watched it with a friend in IMAX. And I'll get into it now. So
good, I can't wait.
Can't wait. So, okay, so actually, I lied. I'm going to do a quick little plot summary for everyone out there who hasn't seen the movie and doesn't know what In the Heights is about. But if you haven't heard of it, if you don't know what it's about, I don't know how you found this podcast, but nonetheless, this is the plot summary on the IMDb page, but it's courtesy of Broadway.com, and you can tell because there's a couple of bit of wordings in here that are the stage show. In the Heights centers on a variety of characters living in the neighborhood of Washington Heights on the northern tip of Manhattan. That is where Washington Heights is, the northern tip of Manhattan. Moving on. At the center of the show is Usnavi, a bodega owner who looks for the aging Cuban lady next door. Who looks after the aging Cuban lady next door, pines for the gorgeous girl working in the neighboring beauty salon, and dreams of winning the lottery and escaping to the shores of his native Dominican Republic. Meanwhile, Nina, a childhood friend of Usnavi's, has returned to the neighborhood from her first year at college with surprising news for her parents, who have spent their life savings on building a better life for their daughter.
Oops.
Ultimately, Usnavi and the residents of the close-knit neighborhood get a dose of what it means to be home. Now, the wording in that is a little off for the movie, because in the stage show, Nina has both of her parents, and in the movie, she just has her father, and we will get to that in a minute. So, what I learned about myself as a human being is that I think I'm inherently distrustful of thin, beautiful women, because... So, the whole thing about Nina coming back from college, you find out she goes off to Stanford, and she comes back from her freshman year at Stanford to announce that she's dropping out. She won't be going back. And she has this big fight with her dad at this big, like, friends and family dinner. And they all, like, go off to the club to blow off steam. I was telling my friend afterwards, I was like, I was really annoyed to, like, see Nina sitting at the club on the sides with, like, her gaggle of friends. And she didn't look like she had a care in the world. I'm like, you just had a big blow-up fight with your dad like 45 minutes ago. You could look a little more bothered. And he goes, oh, she looks bothered to me. I just don't think you trust her resting face. Like, he says, I think you just saw her sitting there being nooch. And you immediately were like, what is that Regina George doing? What is she thinking? What is she plotting? What is she planning? Which is fair. Both the actresses who play Nina and Vanessa, Nina's played by Leslie Grace and Vanessa's played by Melissa Barrera, are stunning individuals. And it's just like unfairly so. It's like any time they walk across the screen, you're just like, you don't, I'm reminded of a line on Grey's Anatomy when they find out that Katherine Heigl used to model. And Sandra Oh goes, if I looked like you, I would just be naked all day. I wouldn't have a job. I wouldn't have skills. I wouldn't know how to read. I would just be naked. I'm like, and not to like say that that's what these two women should do, but like I look at them like, if I looked like you, I wouldn't have skills. I would know that everyone would just do everything for me because I am just that godlike looking. But I don't want to objectify them too much. But as a gay man, we tend to not honestly fetishize, but we tend to objectify beautiful women because we're like, God, I'd want to pee you a little bit. Which I think we envy the fashion that they get to pull off, you know? The nails that they have. Are you saying go for it?
I don't know.
I wear clothes all the time.
I think there's a lot of fashion victim that goes in there, crippling high heels, those long daggers of nails.
You know? But you know what? Grass is always greener because I see the high heels and I go, oh my God, that sounds amazing. That looks incredible. You are a saint. You are a patron saint of fashion. but I've never actually had to experience it myself. So maybe if I put it on, I'd be like, oh my God.
Yes, because you can't fit your foot in my shoes.
I'm sorry that you have a size 2 and that I have normal person feet. God, have you ever thought about having bigger feet? It would make my life so much better.
Well, you could just lop off your toes. Maybe that would help.
Just like in Cinderella.
Yeah.
I agree that 96,000 and I think the opening number are about as good as any number in a movie musical ever. They hold up with anything that's in Singin' in the Rain, Chicago, Cabaret. I think 96,000, which is the pool number for you, Mother, mm-hmm. putting it down for you.
Thank you.
I also, I was saying this last night, they did it wonderfully. However, I was thinking to myself, even if they did a mediocre job, that number would be fire because that...
Did you notice? I mean, with all the splashing?
Well, because say it wasn't in a community pool. Say like they just did it on the street and it was like sort of by the numbers. That number is so technically phenomenal. It just builds in a way that is so precise. And it's mathematics, really. Just like it builds a little bit, it slows down, it builds more, starts to slow down. And then when it gets to the last 2 minutes, that's when every melody we've heard starts to overlap slowly and then like all encompassing. It's very One Day More. In a way that like how music is math, right? It's why so many musicians are so good at math and vice versa. It is so precise. I'm not trying to take away from the emotional heat of that number by saying it's so precise, but it's just like, I've never seen that number fail. I could see that done at like a middle school and it would still get a huge reaction from the audience because that number is just, you know, it's just great.
Something the way you do.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, it would just be interesting. Like, take a tour of your brain. But I mean, the way you kind of are able to hear these different things, I mean, the layering and the eye.
Well, so sure. And there are many people who do that as well. I'll never forget seeing Book of Mormon when, like, right after they won the Tony, and I knew nothing about it. I didn't know how the plot went, I didn't know the score. And the Act One finale begins. And it's this song called Man Up. And then, like, right as in the middle of the song, as we've been hearing this one song for 2.5 minutes, all of a sudden, a character comes on and sings a reprise of her song. And I knew immediately what was about to happen, that it was about to be a mashup of all the numbers we'd heard in Act One. And because the moment she came on stage, for those of you who know Book of Mormon, it's when Nabulungi comes on and she goes, Salt Lake City, a place of hope and joy. I was in standing room and I literally went, oh my God, like, because I knew what was about to happen. I was like, that's what this number is? And 96,000 is kind of the same. Once Vanessa starts to do her verse and then Benny comes in repeating his verse, you're like, oh, that's what's about to happen. Everything's about to mash up and it's going to fit so well. And it's great. It's so exciting. I also love the opening number. I've always loved the opening number. I think it's great. If I had one critique of it in the movie, one critique only, is that when Vanessa comes on screen, which is the great phone call, no, 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 no. I wish that the camera stayed on her a bit longer in the bodega. They cut to Usnavi, Benny, and Sunny. That is Usnavi's cousin, younger cousin Sunny, and Benny, their friend. Them doing like shenanigans, trying to like get Nina's Vanessa's attention, and it's not on Vanessa, but she's singing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, stay on her. Just stay on her. That's my only critique of the opening number. Every other number, I have like some critiques, some big, some small. My biggest issue is like there's one number I think. Maybe two in the whole movie that don't feel overblown. And one is kind of like a small throwaway number towards the beginning. The other one is called Champagne. It's when Usnavi and Vanessa have the big, like, I don't want to call it a showdown, but fight/kiss in Abuela's empty apartment before he goes. And I like it because it feels very human and intimate and personal. I would have liked a little bit more of that with some numbers. There are a lot of numbers where I felt it, like, because the director John M. Chu and the writers had all these concepts for every single number, and it was all very clever. I was like, oh, that's a really interesting way to frame that. But it was all, sometimes it would just get to be too much. I'm like, sometimes edit, you know?
Well, this drilled right down to the emotion. It was very intimate. It was very intimate scene. You're going to kill me, but I was thinking back to the opening number and And also the pool, but if that had been on land, and I'm smiling because what came to mind in comparison was Christmas on the Square.
Christmas on the Square. I love Christmas. We love Christmas on the Square.
We do.
We love Christmas on the Square. It's our new holiday tradition. We might have to watch it again pretty soon. I miss it. I miss that movie. So, like, how so? Like, in terms of just a whole town getting together and, like, singing about the things?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Christmas on the Square is trying to do... Christmas on the Square is basically... an hour and 45 of Dolly Parton thinking she can write 96,000. And I love her dearly. She never writes a 96,000. She has a Wicked Witch of the Middle. Maybe we just rough her up a little. Oh, God. What if someone could mash up Wicked Witch of the Middle from Christmas on the Square with 96,000?
You also think she was green screened in, you think, right?
So she was Dolly Parton was never on set for that movie,
it's hilarious.
A day.
It's hilarious.
She's 100% green screened in. It's amazing. And people claim she was on set. I don't buy it. I don't buy it for a fucking second.
No, not at all. Sorry, I didn't mean to divert attention, but it just was why I was smiling.
You can already tell how much happier I am that we're talking about Christmas on the Square. And the Heights is a much better movie, but Christmas on the Square brings me such joy.
It's funny.
Yeah. So let me talk about a couple more things that I really like in the movie. And you can add on as well. Because, like, as I said, I'm going to be also talking about other critiques that I have. I think that the movie is really well cast. It's definitely the best sung movie musical we've had since Chicago. And I mean,
even Lin-Manuel was okay.
I have some theories about Lin-Manuel Miranda singing Piedagua because he's never sounded like that on stage. And I'm like, either that was a combination of 9,000 takes. He went through vocal military training for like 6 months before, or there was some, you know, auto-tune sweetening, which is also possible.
Or maybe some combination thereof.
Or maybe I'm just a cynical dick and it's all natural talent. I will say sort of the double-edged sword of the casting is, so like Lin-Manuel wrote In the Heights because he wanted to sort of see himself on stage, both like representation of the Latinx community, but also like he was in it. He played Usnavi on Broadway. And think of like a 27, 28 year old Lin. He's not a dashing leading man. Like Anthony Ramos, who plays Usnavi in the movie, is beautiful. And he is cut. Like he has an upside down triangle body. So he looks like a leading man.
It didn't appeal to me, but okay.
Sure. Well, he's also a little young for you, one might say. I'm just saying, he's younger than me, so, but I think he's a very beautiful man, and there was something a little goofy everyman about the way Lin did Usnavi that made him very endearing, even when he could sometimes be a dick, and again, as I said, I'm distrustful of skinny, beautiful women, and the same applies to Anthony Ramos, where, like, there'd be times where I was like, I just wish you were a little funnier, because I'm not finding this woman endearing, I'm finding you to be a little bit of a dick, but... I don't think that human flaws are character flaws in movies. That's not the same thing as a moment where the movie's trying to make a character's action endearing, and I'm like, it's not cute. And in fact, speaking of Lin and Piedagua, so the whole point of Piedagua in the show is that it's sort of like a check-in point, because it's about the community, it's about the neighborhood. Sure. So there's the Piedagua guy. And... to reflect the changing neighborhood, you know, Mr. Softy is making all the money and Piedagua guy is like, I'm just going to keep scraping by. And in the movie, that's the role Lin plays. And it doesn't really do much for the plot. It's kind of just there for him to do something. But there's a moment where he's like rolling down the sidewalk singing and he takes his syrup and he like nonchalantly pours it on two kids' ice creams from Mr. Softy. And I was like, listen, I hate children as much as the next person, but fuck you. Those kids did nothing wrong except trying to enjoy some ice cream on a hot summer day, and you just had to pour syrup on it and ruin it for them.
That was mean. That wasn't nice.
That's the one where the movie's like, haha, funny joke. I'm like, no, that's a dick move. Dick move. I'll say it to the day I die. That was a dick move, Lin, and I hope he's aware of it. I need that apology.
You know why? Because it was also so out of place with the rest of the movie, which, you know, even though there was some emotional stuff, it was pretty sanitized. If you think about it, there was no profanity in it at all.
Very little, very little. The show has very little profanity. And I think...
What, they say darn? I don't remember.
No, I think they say shit a couple of times.
Did they?
Mm-hmm. But it's very quick. Yeah. The musical, as I said, was already kind of considered a sanitized version of Washington Heights. Mm-hmm. And there is actually a little bit of violence in the stage show, of which there is none in the movie. The movie takes out all the violence, there's no homelessness, there's no crime.
There was one shoplift thing, but that was it.
But it was, again, played for laughs.
Right.
It was indicated that it was like a friend of Sonny's who took something when Sonny wasn't watching the store. But so, I will also say things I really liked about it. I thought there were some song placements that they did that worked a lot better. For example, so Nina's opening song is called Breathe. And normally that's the second song on the show, but they switched it so that way Benny on the Dispatch came first and then Breathe, which I like for the same reason that I like in Les Mis that they switched Lovely Ladies and I Dreamed a Dream. Because in a stage show, in order for us to follow a character's journey, we usually need a moment for them to sing about themselves. But in a movie, it's the reverse. We need to watch someone's journey for a little bit before we watch them sing a song to themselves.
That makes sense.
And In the Heights very smartly does that. They move Nina's song to after Benny's Dispatch, so we've seen Nina for a few minutes. I keep hitting my mic. But it's the same thing with Vanessa and her song, It Won't Be Long Now. Usually that's before the nail salon number. They moved it to after, so we've seen more of Vanessa by that point. I also thought that they did a really good job with Vanessa in the movie. In the show, she's much more of a secondary character. The musical is much more about Nina and Usnavi. Like, they are the core of the characters in the show. And it's an ensemble show. And the movie, Vanessa's much more of a fighting character. However, there's a double-edged sword to that, because I do think that comes at the detriment of Nina's character. And granted, in the show, I always kind of found Nina to be a downer. I did not necessarily enjoy her character much on stage. But... I was always engaged in what she was doing, even if I was like, smile, not to be a dude who tells a woman to smile, but I'm like, another ballad about how you feel out of place, like, come on, like, can we get something new now?
She also came across as ungrateful, you know, understanding, right, that it wasn't necessarily what she wanted, but the sacrifices that her father went through to...
Okay, yes. Okay, so now once I've said that now, so I'll also say, I also do love the unapologeticness of it being a musical. Criticisms I have. So one of the major changes they did with Nina in the movie that I don't like is why she drops out. In the stage show, she drops out of Stanford because it's the first time a hurdle was too much for her and she couldn't clear it. She got to Stanford and she didn't do well. She couldn't keep up her grades because she was also working another job so she could pay for like books and stuff like that, even with her scholarships and whatnot. And so she drops out because it was just too much. And she feels like a failure because of it and she doesn't want to go back. She eventually does go back. The movie makes it that she's dropping out of Stanford because she got there and she talks about how she has no community out there. There's no Latin community out there for me. I felt all alone. And on top of that, like, there are racist people there. And I understand the weight of that. Also, I also have issues with the big reveal where she's like, my very first day there, I got searched because we moved in and my roommate lost her pearl necklace and her parents and the RA, like, overturned all my stuff. And then they end up finding it in her bag. And I had two thoughts. One was, any dorm room, if your roommate loses something, they're going to search your stuff. In the same way that when a wife goes missing, they always think it's the husband first. Like,
right. And it's the first day, so, you know.
Yeah. But also, like, if Stanford had been that blatantly racially targeted about it, my God, could she have gotten, like, $90 million from them?
You know, the whole thing isn't particularly politically oriented. Like, it's not making a statement politically, except for the fact when Nina says, and I just apologized.
Yeah.
And, you know, that took it to a different level of gravitas, which never played out, I don't think, through the whole movie.
They so we'll get to it in a second, because they try to tie to it. We'll get to it now. They tried to tie it to how she was always politically active with Sunny, and they go to a protest, and she's deciding, I'm going to go back to Stanford, and I'm going to help the Dreamers, which is something that's added in the movie. It's not in the stage show. And
for currency.
For currency, yeah. Although I also had issues with that plot line for the same way that they redid the Lotto plot line. The lottery is a much more discussed plot line in the stage show. It pops up more often, whereas in the movie, both the Dreamers and the lottery are discussed at the beginning and then drop for over an hour and then come back at the end. Mm. And that's a personal thing with storytelling that I don't enjoy, where something is discussed a lot and then not discussed again for a long period of time and then brought back up again like nothing happened. And I'm like, I don't like that.
That's the sloppiness.
That I'm talking about, yes. There are other sloppy things I'll mention for a second that in a minute, which could be considered nitpicking. However, so much thought went into so much of this movie, and especially about like how to rethink of it as a film, that I'm like, did no one catch this? Especially because this movie has been in development for so long. I'm like, did no one catch that moment there?
The Abuela thing?
No, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So, but I know exactly what you're talking about with Abuela. But so with Nina, the fact that it's everyone else was the problem, not her, takes away the sense of shame of like, I wasn't enough. It's more that I got there and it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And then to her tell her father and everyone else like, no, the prejudice you dealt with is different from the prejudice I'm dealing with. You don't know. And it's like, you don't know what you don't know, Nina. Like, you don't know what your father went through or what your abuela went through or anyone else. Like, it's awful out there for a lot of people. And I just don't like the idea of my trauma is special. I don't like glamorizing trauma that way. And, like, my opinion matters because I have trauma.
Well,
like,
there was something a little princessy about her.
And maybe it's because, because she's a beautiful thin girl.
She is beautiful.
I'm like, how dare you? But you know what I mean? Like, I feel like people now use trauma as like a point of being like a validation of like, my opinion matters because I have all this baggage with me. And like, trauma is not something you want to have. It shouldn't be something that you wish on anybody or that you should have as validation. Like, you don't want your child to ever have trauma. So you shouldn't be like, I don't know. I just don't like the idea of glamorizing it. But that's also sort of where the internet is at these days. Where like, as a person who has experienced X, Y, and Z, my opinion is greater than yours. Which I don't love. That said, I already forgot my point. Oh, so as I said, in the stage show, Nina has both of her parents. In the movie, they kill off her mom. And I don't necessarily know why they do it, other than just to streamline the number of characters, like make it fewer characters.
And Jimmy Smith is like the only marquee name that you know, so maybe it was to make him a more featured character.
It's entirely possible. I was confused because they took out the mom, but then they added a third salon lady. Because in the show, it's just two women. And they added a third one, Kuka, played by Dasha Polanco, who is from Orange is the New Black. And I was like, did they add her just to have Dasha in there? Because she's like a kind of well-known Latina actress due to Orange is the New Black.
Was she the heavier one? Or
yes. And she doesn't have a lot of lines because they would try to give her some of the throwaway lines that Daniela and Carla had to her, but Daniela and Carla are the ones who like have actual material still, so she just sort of felt like the third wheel. I would have liked, if you're going to kill off one of Nina's parents, because her mom being dead really didn't mean anything to the story. There was nothing about like, they would sometimes say your mom, may she rest in peace, but there was never like about, oh, my mom went through this, what does this mean for me? I feel, if you're going to kill off one of Nina's parents, kill off the dad, have her mom have to have taken over the business from the dad years ago and, you know, struggled but survived and, like, given a piece of it away so she can fund Nina's college. And then, like, when Nina says, like, no, I'm not taking the money, I'm not going back, you don't get it, there would have been a really phenomenal dynamic of these two women of different generations in the same family of, like, what I went through to get you to where you are and you're going to stop because it's tough. Like, it was tough for me too. I felt like there would have been a really great dynamic with two women doing that.
Yeah, but you know, I felt something different because I thought that the father, you know, sort of a Latin value, the sort of the protecting the daughter, mm-hmm. protecting the floweriness of the daughter in a way, and his I don't know. I thought it worked. I thought it worked just to have
some people thought it worked. I'm not saying it didn't work. I thought it was fine. I thought it would have been improved if it was her mother instead of her father who
it might have been too dark that way.
Not dark. Just like I thought there would have been more edge to it. I thought there was a lack of tension. Because also in the stage show regarding to Nina, she and Benny are not exes in the show. They're sort of like both kind of eyeing each other very Romeo and Juliet, like, will they, won't they? And then there's the added tension of that Nina's father doesn't approve. But so by removing that for the movie, I felt there was no tension with Nina and Benny. Now they're exes, and right. It's slowly finding their way back to each other. There's no conflict from Nina's dad about it.
There's no tension and there was no chemistry. I couldn't feel
it. It was well, and I think that's sort of the problem with making them exes is that when you're exes with somebody, but it was not a dynamic breakup and you're on like kind of good terms, then it just becomes lived in. Like, we know each other in a very intimate way and we're not like angry at each other. We do still kind of like each other. But we're also kind of on friendly terms. So it's just very, I don't say comfortable. It's a very comfortable kind of energy. So there's nothing like sexually charged about it, which in the stage show, while I'll say again, like, Nina's not my favorite character in the show, that dynamic with Benny has that sexual charge to it. And act one ends with them kissing during the blackout, which is always like a really heated moment. That doesn't happen in the movie, obviously, because the movie takes the musical argument that Nina and Benny have in the show and they give it to Vanessa Unusnavi. And again, I like Vanessa and I love the actress who played her. So I'm like, yeah, give her more screen time. That's absolutely fine. But it does come to the detriment of Nina's character for me. Blackout, which is when they're in the club and obviously the lights go out, was probably the number I was most disappointed by because that number is fire on stage. It is so good. And there's a lot that they cut. And I don't necessarily begrudge them cutting things. If it's about making things flow and more cinematic, fine, whatever. But similar to 96,000, or like just musically speaking, the way that Blackout works on stage is so, everything just sort of fits and goes right into the other so smoothly. Like, it's when you cut stuff, it just feels like kind of truncated. And then also, like, for a movie that gets off on having people do actions to the rhythm of the song, so like spraying the sidewalk to the beat, playing checkers to the beat, that blackout happens when they're in the club and it's like a big drum beat or like bum, 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 bum. To not have them banging on the doors to the beat of the song and having close-ups of their hands, like open these goddamn doors. I'm like, that was like, it's there in the music.
Right.
That, like, and for a movie that does this all the time, I'm like, this is the moment you choose not to do that? Like, this, like, should absolutely be there.
It would have been good.
And the idea of, like, all these bodies switched together and people are freaking out and, like, lights are flashing because everyone's using their phones trying to see and then people are breaking out. Like, I never got that energy from that number. And I was like, if ever there was a number where that could have happened, it was that one.
Oye, ¿qué pasó? Blackout, blackout.
Vino el apagón, ay Dios.
Oye, ¿qué pasó? Blackout, blackout. Vino el apagón, ay Dios.
There was some sort of surprising, not good-natured teasing that happened, you know, when they say about Benny and Nina, the roll in the hay thing.
Okay. Okay.
And then also the ice cream.
The ice cream thing pissed me off. But again, also because like Lynn's whole MO is like that he's such a nice guy. And maybe it's also because I'm a bit Lin-Manuel Miranda'd out right now. I went to the drama bookshop last week on the day of opening. And while it's beautiful, they did a lovely job with it. It has a bit of a feeling of like a shrine to him that kind of put me off. And because he and Tommy Kail are the ones who like saved it. I'm like, oh, so like you walk in and there's like a Hamilton in the Heights table. And at the back, they have two chairs that are replicas of chairs from the Hamilton set, which I thought was just like, I heard that sentence out loud from an employee and I was like, oh, these are replicas of chairs from the show. Like, it's as if saying, this shoe that I'm holding right now This is a shoe that Philippa Sue was looking at but didn't purchase while they were rehearsing Hamilton.
It's like going to the wax museum.
But like the wax museum of people who like were on the sidewalk during history weren't actually part of the history. You know, like this is a wax replica of a woman who was walking on her way to the post office while history happened. Like, yeah. What? So this goes into what I was talking about earlier about some things that weren't changed that make no sense now. First off, Abuela's number, Paciencia y Fe, happens much earlier in the show. It happens right after 96,000. So when everyone's like, who won the lottery? No one knows. Paciencia y Fe is normally Abuela revealing to the audience that she's the one that won the lottery. Huh. She, in fact, when she says, like, in the movie, I think they changed the lyrics, like, what do I do? No, I made it, or something like that. But in the musical, she goes, what do I do with this winning ticket? And everyone in the audience goes, like, oh my God, it's her. Because up until that moment, we've only just seen Abuela sort of, like, coming in and out. She's, like, the really lovable grandmother. She has a moment with every person, and she seems very positive. And then as she's feeding birds on the sidewalk, which is something she likes to do, her inner monologue starts to shout, calor, calor, which a friend of the pod, I won't say his name, he was really upset that in the movie she whispers calor at the beginning of it, because he's like, she's saying how hot she is, and she's like whispering, and I'm like, I know, buddy, I know. Anyway, but so, and it's this sort of angry song about, you know, all the things she went through, and now her dream has finally arrived. She has the line, she's like, what do you do when your dreams come true? And what she means is, I won $96,000, and it happens now when I'm at this age, and on top of that, like, my mother's not even around to, like, enjoy it with me. What do I do with that? So, like, there's a sense of guilt about her mom can't be there to share with it, and she feels guilty about having this luck now, and then pissed that it took this long.
Well, you know, you're lucky to have seen the show, because that didn't even click for me. It was so disjointed.
Yeah, well, so I want to ask you with Paciencia y Fe, and we're going to go into the, this leads into my detail picking going in, but, like, what did that number mean to you when watching the movie, Paciencia y Fe? Because it comes later in the movie, and it's the song she sings right before she dies now.
In the subway.
On the subway, yes. That's like recreating her life story.
I don't know. It seemed sort of random in a way. I mean, obviously it was when she was just about to die, and she was looking at the white light, and she was trying to figure, and maybe she was raging against the light, but she was trying to figure out stay or go, and she says that. But it seemed almost, you know, for that, for her having been on her bed doing that whole subway thing without understanding how it was connected, seemed overblown.
Mm-hmm.
Because someone told me it didn't make sense to me.
Someone told me they felt like the song was representing Abuela's train ride to the afterlife.
Oh God, really?
Which, and I was like, I guess that's fair, but I also don't think that was their intention. Really, I think that Lynn thought it would be really visually interesting to have her whole life be played out on a subway.
I think it was artifice, you know, and it didn't work for me because everything else was above ground in the whole entire movie. And then this, she's such a wonderful, happy, loving character, to be subterranean and having this rage is just, it maybe, you know, is the movie that deep that we need to understand that rage?
But I think the movie's trying to be, I think the movie is trying to have its cake and eat it too, of being this lighthearted entertainment, but also have that meat to it, which I totally respect. I love that they tried to do that. But then you go into the nitty gritty of like, how well do they succeed at that?
And they give with one hand and take away with the other, and they undermine their intensity, I think.
And I did think, I also say Paciencia y Fe was a number that I liked a lot more on the big screen because the first two times I did not like it. I thought that the number overwhelmed Abuela. She did not feel like the center of it.
Yeah.
Because that is her song. It's her story. And then seeing on a big screen, I felt much more like she was the center of it. It also has some really great cuts in it when they have beams of light representing each decade. Like the days into weeks, the weeks into years. And then she goes to grab the beam of light and it cuts and she's on the subway again with the subway pole. However, that then goes into a problem I have,
which is a lyric
she has, because in the stage show, she is feeding birds, and that is what she's doing while she has this inner monologue, and she has the lyric, and as I feed these birds, my hands begin to shake. She still sings that line, but she's on a subway. There are no birds around. Now, the third time watching it, and also this is now going into a lot of other stuff, because each time I've now watched the movie, I've discovered another moment similar to this, where like a lyric or a line from the stage show comes in, and I'm like, oh, they actually cut something that line was referring to, so now that line means nothing. But the third time I was trying to see if there was any justification for the bird line, and then I think they have a shot where she has these like glass birds or like porcelain birds on her like dresser, I think is what it was, but I also don't buy that that's what it was referring to. It just looked like he was looking at, that Usnavi was looking at trinkets of Abuela, things to remember her by. Because then in Alabanza, which is the song where they're all sort of mourning her, he has a line where he's like, I like to imagine she, you know, is somewhere with breadcrumbs in her hand, which is referring to how she always liked to feed the birds. But she never does that in the movie. So I'm like, what the fuck does that line mean now? And then if you think I'm being really like picky about this, there are other moments in the movie that are just like this. For example, now that Nina and Benny are exes, her being in the nail salon and then going, I heard you've been talking to Benny. I hear he's got quite a big taxi.
Yeah, right.
In the stage show, it's cute because Nina and Benny have never hooked up. And it's like, it's sort of Daniela being like pushing her to hook up with Benny. Right. Like, I don't know. I heard he's packing a stretch limousine. If they're exes, most likely Nina has seen it. And right. You were just telling Nina, I heard your ex-boyfriend's got a big old dong.
Like, I know. That's very distasteful, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, during Carnaval de Barrio, when Daniela goes, I hear you and Nina went for a roll in the hay, that's a reference in the stage show, because at the end of Act 1, they make out, and Act 2 opens with the morning after, and they've had sex. And you think it's this like quiet moment, only to find out that the whole block knows. But the movie, there is not a single reference that they have hooked up.
No.
They do not make it. In fact, at the blackout, they actually part ways, because Benny decides to go to the dispatch to like get all right. the taxis back. So that
but
line.
She was angry at him for going back.
She wasn't angry. I think she was a little PO'd, but she like got it. Vanessa was pissed off at Usnavi for, quote unquote, abandoning her, which, in the musical, he actually does. He when the blackout happens, he runs out and goes to find Abuela.
Right, but didn't Nina say something like "Don't go, don't go"?
Yeah, and he's like, "I have to," and then she. Right. But then she lets him. So it's not super PO'd. But then another moment that I was like. And again, each time I've watched it, I found another moment. I'm like, if I watch this movie a fourth time, which is going to be like 3 years from now, I can't watch it for a while. But if I watch it a fourth time, I'm going to find another moment. But another moment I found was when they get to the club and it's Vanessa and Usnavi and they're walking down and they're singing and she's like, relax. She goes, let's get a drink. And he says something sweet. And she goes, you know me, a little bit of cinnamon. That line means nothing in the movie because what it's referencing is an interaction that the two have in the show. During Vanessa's number, it won't be long now, where he makes her, I think it's like coffee with cinnamon mm-hmm. and condensed milk. And she goes, oh, like my abuela used to do. And he goes, that's what all the girls say, that I remind them of their grandma. It's a cute little, like, you know, menschy moment. But, you know, he knows that she likes cinnamon in her coffee. So when they go to the bar and he goes, something sweet, she goes, you know me, a little bit of cinnamon. But that interaction isn't in the movie. There's no reference to her liking cinnamon in
it's
anything.
Random. It's
so she's
like
you know me, a little bit of cinnamon. I'm like, is that supposed to be like a weird, like poetic come on now? Like, it means nothing. It means nothing. And again, I know this is like harsh little details that I'm talking about, but like it popped out to me. And I also know that the Abuela Birds line popped out to a lot of people. Because when every time I've said, I have some moments that stick out to me, everyone has gone, oh, the Birds line. Even people I know who loved the movie. They're like, yeah, the Birds line. It's weird. It makes no sense. And it's just so blatant. I also felt, and I'm trying to hide the names of the people who have these feelings because I know that Lin-Manuel Miranda's mafia is out there coming for everyone. I've already resigned myself to the fact that I'm going to get taken out by the Lin crowd, so I'm blatant about it. But all other interested parties, I'm going to keep them anonymous. But a friend I spoke to the other day who has a very deep connection to the show, he likes the movie and he respects that they really worked hard to make it a movie. He likes it a lot. But he did say that he felt that Abuela was shortchanged in the movie. Mm. Whereas in the stage show, when she dies, it is like a gut punch because she dies midway through Act 2. And also by that point, Usnavi knows she won the lottery. So the way that Abuela's storyline works in the show is she's introduced. She's really sweet. She has a moment with Nina. She's got a moment with Usnavi. She's like in and out. She's a really sweet girl. Also, in 96,000, she's the one who says, "Ay, alabanza," and they give it to a random person in the movie. I get, expand it. But when he's like, "Oh, she used to say alabanza all the time," she never says it in the movie, as far as I'm aware. And I've seen the movie 3 times now. She says it a couple times in the show, especially in 96,000. She says alabanza. It's just like those little details where, like, as I said, I don't love the script of the stage show, but they do a good job of incorporating these details about characters that when they make reference to them later, it's like, yeah, they did do that.
I mean, it sounds like continuity issues and like why it had to have been a conscious, they couldn't have been oblivious to the fact.
I think by looking at the bigger picture of how to sort of shift it to modern day and then to make it work for the screen, a lot of details kind of went by the wayside. But it's also those details that make the most of it. And it's also unfair in a lot of ways because I've just recently watched WandaVision for the first time. I binged watched it in the day and then I watched it again a couple of days later. And I'm not someone I don't know the Marvel universe at all. So the show was confusing for a while, and then I figured it out. And then I watched it again, knowing what I know. And that show is airtight with how they like mapped everything out, continuity with characters, with details, like just little touches where I'm like, the amount of thought that went into this from everyone. And like, they have the same amount of time to prep for it that in the Heights had. It's just like, some things just fall by the wayside, but it's those details that matter. Anywho, my friend was saying, with Abuela in the show, build all this up. After 96,000, it is revealed she's the one that wins the lottery. They do the dinner scene, Nina blows up, and then when the blackout happens, Usnavi rushes to Abuela's apartment to see if everything's all right, and Abuela says, like, you need to guard this money with your life, and he realizes that she has $96,000 cash now in her apartment.
Oh.
And then the morning after, they're going to use that money to go to DR. And I even think he has a line about it in Carnaval de Barrio, and then she dies immediately after Carnaval de Barrio. And then in the show, what happens is when she dies, he's still going to go. And then Sonny and Graffiti Pete do something. So there's also like a running gag about how the grate for the bodega is broken. And then in Blackout, Sonny's all alone with the bodega and he can't get the grate down because it's broken and they get looted. So there's like a little bit of violence and there's a little bit of danger in Blackout in the show that's not in the movie because no one loots it. One of the plot lines in Blackout in the show is that there's looting happening and they don't do that in the movie. And I can understand they don't want to have that like negative representation.
Particularly now.
But, well, the movie was made in 2019. But it adds a sense of danger to the number and heightens everything, which I think is important. As in the movie Blackout for me was just sort of like a whatever number. Anywho, but so after it's looted and Usnavi's still going to go, Graffiti Pete and Sonny fix the grate for the bodega and they paint a portrait of Abuela on it with Paciencia y Fe on it. And that's what makes Usnavi stay. In the movie, what do they do in the movie to the bodega, Mother?
They make it look like DR on the inside.
Mm-hmm. With a little, like, Paciencia y Fe in the corner. But it's not a tribute to Abuela.
No, not at all.
I like that they have Vanessa included in it, but it's like, Vanessa's now a fashion designer or aspiring fashion designer in the movie, which is fine. It's a good detail. I enjoy it. But it's also about, like, how she can't be creative now that she's moved downtown, and then she, like, gets inspired and she makes these dresses that she shows Usnavi, and, like, Graffiti Pete paints the Dominican Republic on the walls of the bodega, and that's what makes Usnavi stay. Whereas in the show, the whole purpose is that
it was a combination of that and the fact that Vanessa was involved, because they never consummated or even decided to be together by the time he was going to leave. They were on the cusp, right? The champagne, and then he was going to leave.
So, like, the show, a lot of it is about home. Like, where is home? What does home mean? And Usnavi's trying to go back to DR because that's where he thinks his home is. And then it's the very, very end of the show when he sees the Abuela portrait and he realizes, oh, my home is here. Because not only is it because it's where Abuela was, but he realizes that Abuela meant so much to other people and other people were paying attention. So, like, in the show, Sonny and Graffiti Pete seem like kind of just dopey characters who, like, don't take any emotion in. And then the fact that they make this mural of Abuela, he's like, you guys did this? Like, you two, like... And it moved him. He's like, I underestimated you and I underestimated how much you saw and felt. And it's a really beautiful moment. The movie, it's a little more of like, you don't have to go to DR because we made it here for you.
You're right, right, right. Well, so Sonny was resistant. He didn't want to go.
He didn't want to go, yeah. Whereas in the show, I don't think he includes Sonny in going to DR. I don't remember, but I don't think he does. I think it was just going to be him and Abuela.
And what was the point of Sonny's father?
You mean played by...
Mark Anthony, yeah.
Former Mr. Jennifer Lopez, yes. Mark Anthony?
Yes.
The first time I saw it, I was like, you can't have Mark Anthony play Sonny's father. At least not for that kind of scene where it's his only scene. It's supposed to be this big dramatic scene of like, Sonny's father is a drunk and his father's kind of like a deadbeat. And it's played by a super famous dude and like recognizable too. It's... John Mulaney has this joke with Law and Order how like sometimes they'll get really famous people for guest spots,
yeah.
And you'll always know their character is the one that did it because like they're the ones,
and
like,
they can be in and out because they have no continuing plot.
Yeah, like they're just there for that one episode. But he talked about how like Dean Cain of Lois and Clark fame played a suspect in an assault episode, and there's a scene where the woman who gets assaulted has to like pick the guy out in the lineup, and John Mulaney's like, I wanted nothing more than for that woman to look through the lineup and go, is that Dean Cain?
Like, that's so good. Because,
like, that's all you think about. So, like, there's an episode of Law & Order where Sutton Foster plays, I think, no, sorry, no, Jane Krakowski. Sutton Foster is on an episode of Law & Order, but the episode I'm thinking of is Jane Krakowski is, like, the sister, I think, of a hospital administrator or whatever, and you find out she's like been killing all these old people in the ward, and you're like, you know it's gonna be her because it's Jane Krakowski and she's not gonna be in it to do one scene.
Well, you remember, to me there's a real life version of that where people looked up at the judge and said, wait, is that Richard Tickton, my father, right? And so my mother woke up in the middle of the night with Law and Order playing. She couldn't sleep or whatever it was. And my parents have been divorced for a very long time. She looks up and there's her ex-husband, my father, on the screen. She thought she was hallucinating. It was playing, pretty funny.
My grandfather played a judge on an episode of Law and Order
Judge
once.
Wolf or something? Something Wolf, I don't
know.
I remember.
I don't know.
But it was funny that she saw him.
Well, no, the equivalent of that would be if Nanny were in the episode 2 playing Nanny. And then Papa San shows up as the judge, and he's like, Miss Tickton, do you have anything to say about your defendant? And Nanny to look at Papa San and go, are you my ex-husband?
Yeah, but it was funny. It was a funny moment. It's like, wait, what?
And maybe I'm alone in this. I just, because I didn't know Mark Anthony had a cameo in the movie. So when he popped up, I was like, what? And it's supposed to be this, like, big dramatic scene, and all I could think of was, oh my god, Mark Anthony has a scene in this movie.
And it was so heavy and dark compared to the rest. It almost was gratuitous in a way.
I don't know if it was gratuitous. I thought it was just a bad case of celebrity casting, because he was, and he did a, he did a lovely job. And if he weren't Mark Anthony, I wouldn't think anything of it. I would think, what a lovely job that scene just did. But it's those things you have to think about, like, I don't know.
Is
like
it
you,
distracting?
You can't have, like, Dolly Parton play a random bank teller in a serious scene in a movie, because all you're going to think about is, that's Dolly fucking Parton, like, playing this random-ass bank teller. Who are some actors that you really liked in this movie?
Well, as I said, I wasn't so wild about Nina, but we don't know if that's direction or writing or whatever.
Or both.
Yeah. I really liked Vanessa. I liked the... beauty shop owner. I thought
Daphne
Rubin
Vega. Daphne Rubin Vega and Stephanie Beatrice, who plays Carla, her dumb lover. They're still my favorite ones in the movie. After having seen it 3 times, they are my favorites. The first time, the second time, the third time. They're so good.
They felt like the stepmother and the two stepsisters from Cinderella. You know, there was just something coarser about them, you know.
I wish that their number in the salon, No Me Diga, I wish it was a little less busy. Mm-hmm. It's such a funny number, and they do such a good job with it. And there's a lot of great visuals about it, but there's just so much going on.
Yeah.
Especially, like, because, again, as I said, that number is so fucking funny. And so just, like, have slightly smaller moments so the line can get the laugh.
Yeah.
There are so many visual jokes, but there are also things that I was like, oh, I like that. That's cute. Like, how they kick their feet up in the chair, like, to the beat of the song. You know what I said? Like, they love... This movie loves to have people do things that are, like, mundane to the beat of music.
That's cool.
You know, it is cool. But again, why wasn't that happening in Blackout?
I know. This may surprise you, but I liked Benny. And I felt...
Why does that surprise me?
Oh, I don't know. Because he really is a little bit tangential in a way.
What does that word mean?
Tangential?
Yeah.
You know what it means.
Do I? I'm famously dumb. What does that word mean?
On the side, it's like, you know, there are...
Okay.
Tangent goes in another direction, kind of. So, really, Matthew?
I never said I was smart. I just said I was loud and opinionated. You are brilliant,
and I always thought you had a great vocabulary, but there you go.
I have a decent vocabulary, but I have blind spots. Anyway, go ahead. Tangential. I've learned a new word today.
I thought he was a little bit tangential, but... My heart went out to him a lot because I felt like he was pining for Nina and really felt warmly, very warmly toward her, was in love with her, and that she kind of put up a, she was a little cold, right? She put up a little
she
bit
is
of a
cold,
cold
in the movie,
shoulder.
Yeah.
And I just kept thinking, this is unrequited love and so sad.
Yeah. The, Benny is such a mensch, and Corey Hawkins, who plays it in the movie, does a really great job.
He does. And going back to the dispatch to do that, and the, yeah. that was really...
I love Benny's Dispatch. That was one of my favorite songs in the show, and I thought they did a very good job with it
in
the movie.
They did.
And it's one of that and Champagne are the two numbers where like, oh, people.
Yeah,
it's,
real.
Yeah. And because every song otherwise like feels a bit like a music video because each one has its own visual language. So like in 96,000, they have like the air chalk drawings happening like while they're discussing plans with their money. When the sun goes down, which is the Nina Benny duet at the end, like they're dancing on the side of the building, and it's these things where I'm like, that's visually cool, but I'm not,
I didn't like that at all.
I don't like that number.
It felt like shtick.
Well, it felt like Baz Luhrmann. It felt very Moulin Rouge, but Moulin Rouge is very specific about why it does what it does when it does it. Moulin Rouge is all told in the flashback of Ewan McGregor, so the way that he sees Paris when he's young and, like, naive, and the way he, like, is overwhelmed by the Moulin Rouge, that's how he remembers
it. But that's thematic.
That's storytelling. That's right. It all goes into it. Whereas this was just, like, it would be really cool if they danced on the side of a building. Someone said to me that they would have preferred... The song where Nina and Benny sing together earlier, it's called When You're Home, where they're, like, going through the neighborhood. They said they would have preferred that Nina and Benny, like, run along the tops of buildings for that number. Because that would have been them overviewing the whole community.
Sure.
Although I also thought that When You're Home was a little too broad. So I was like, I don't know, maybe them being on the buildings would have been one step too far for me. But also, this is such a tiny little thing to piss me off about. But it pissed me off the first time. It always pisses me off. When they're dancing on the side of the building... And you see them, like, dance in front of a window, and a family's eating, and then, like, the kid sees them out the window, he's like, what? That pisses me off. Because the joke is obviously, like, everyone going, ha, 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 he sees it, too. And, like, he knows, he sees how ridiculous it is. And I'm like, okay, so what you're telling me, then, is that in this world, Nina and Benny actually have the ability to dance on the side of a building. Because a child just saw them do it.
Right, right. It validates it or something.
Well, it's just like...
It concretizes
it. These things don't exist in a vacuum. Like, one thing then must mean another. And because, as I said, I just came out of WandaVision, which is so precise about its world building. I'm sure there are incongruities with that as well that I'm unaware of because I don't know MCU that well. But from my perspective, the world building in WandaVision is pretty airtight. And sometimes I'm like, you gotta throw the... sometimes you gotta kill your darlings and, like, cut the joke of the kids seeing them just so we can, like, live in the fantasy of them dancing on the side of the building that it's not real.
They'd already lost me because I found it so hokey.
I just didn't understand why. And maybe someone can explain to us why that was important, why that made sense.
Maybe trying to put energy in that relationship or something, but it didn't. I found it distracting. And
there are a lot of things I find distracting in the numbers in this movie. As I said, I find a lot of the numbers to be a little too big. Even Vanessa's number, the It Won't Be Long Now, which is about her trying to escape the barrio, and honestly, eventually her escaping New York. But the number is her going to check out the apartment downtown, but also, like, her finding trash and, like, using it to make her fashions. And I'm like, I like that you gave her action to do, but what she's doing isn't really connected to the song she's singing. It's it in a way, it's like, I guess it's meant to be like Vanessa's inner monologue while she, like, goes about her day, which would be fine if, like, the rest of the number weren't, like, specifically about her trying to escape. Something that a friend, same friend who hates that Abuela does not shout calor, he doesn't like that when Vanessa sings how the boys on the street whistle at her. the boys aren't doing that when she sings it. She walks by two different guys who bother her, but they're bothering her with like pamphlets. So it's like, have a moment for the environment. And she's like, the boys whistle at me. I'm like, they weren't whistling at you. They were giving you like paperwork.
It's funny.
I mean, but yeah, again, distrustful of beautiful thin women. It's, I don't know. It's like,
you'd be amazed at how many people are.
Oh yeah. Yes. My mom is famously thin and beautiful and everyone is very distrustful of her.
But it
now makes me laugh in that number, because in the show, when she's singing it, like, it's actually happening to her, that men are like catcalling her. And we see two men, like, I don't want to say they catcall her, because they aren't like offensive. They're just up in her personal space. They're like, Vanessa, please go out with me. I love you. It's like a little more, it should be a little more gross and a little more distant. And just like random guys who don't know her from the next person, sexualizing her and whistling at her from across the street, and we see her brush it off. Whereas in the movie, where she's like, the boys whistle at me, it's like, those two guys wanted you to sign up for like a mailing list. They weren't catcalling you.
It's funny, because in a way it felt sort of sanitized, right?
It wasn't a very sexual movie either.
Disneyfied in a way.
Yeah. It wasn't very sexual, wasn't very violent, wasn't very sweaty. And the show is not very violent, but there's a little bit. The show's not very sexual, but there's a little bit. And both of those things got taken out, which just made it a little less interesting to me. And I should emphasize again, I did like this movie.
So did I. Second time I cried. Okay, first time I didn't. I did cry.
I didn't cry, but that doesn't mean I didn't find something moving. I found Alabanza quite moving. I think Alabanza is just a beautiful song. Crying is a, you know, very specific reaction to things, and it's usually something that triggers us. I have told you this. When I cry at a movie, it's usually because of a specific thing. Do you remember what I said?
I don't remember, but I know the sense of
it. It's when a parent in a movie realizes that their, like, sensitive child is sensitive. I always cry. I cried at the end of Paddington 2. I always will. But the scene I always reference when it comes to, like, when I say that I didn't cry in the Heights, take this into account. Like, this is what makes me cry every time, is in the Lego movie when Will Ferrell realizes that his son, who's playing with his Legos, wasn't making a mess, but was actually making really creative scenarios with the Legos. He looks around and he looks at his son, who he was like just mad at 10 minutes ago. And he looks at him and he goes, you made this? And then he like gets down on his knees to his son's level and hugs him. And I cry every time. But that's a specific thing for me. Get closer to your mic, love.
Do you feel that your parent or parents didn't know that you were creative?
No, I know you knew.
Okay.
No one bats 1,000, though. I wouldn't say you guys were consistent with it. There were times when you tried to get me to try other things that were not my wheelhouse. But I don't begrudge you that, because I had those experiences and it's great fodder for my one-man show.
It's also what parents do.
Sure. I will say, first, I think I was a very specific child where it was very clear where my interests lied very early on. And in retrospect, I would have liked more of that. I got plenty of it. I got plenty of support from you guys about it. I would have liked more. But also, like, coulda, woulda, shoulda, honey. I'm where I'm at now, and I'm happy with where I'm at right now, and I think I can only get better from here.
And in fairness, if we had lived in the city then, you would have had many more outlets and options for things to do and ways to express.
If we lived in the city, I'm convinced I would be the mayor of Broadway by now.
It's not too late.
Well, I don't think it's what Broadway wants. I think everyone who knows me is like, God, Matt, please don't ever get into any kind of power with like Broadway, because you have a very specific taste. But Sarah actually asked me on Saturday. She was like, she asked me about if maybe like the reason I wasn't so like overwhelmed by like this one thing is like, maybe it's like you just don't connect to that. And I said, Sarah, I connect to quality.
God.
I'm attracted to things that are good. But I did actually wonder about this. Is it possible to love something and know it's not the best?
Of course.
Are there any movies or TV shows or books or whatever that you're like, I love this, but I know it's not?
What do you think loving people is about?
Not, First of all, how dare you bring emotions and humans into this? I'm talking about the very real relationship of you and a movie. Not of you and another human being, you psychopath.
There are plenty of things that are satisfying and, you know, we sort of satisfy a sweet tooth in a way, but they're not necessarily good or, yeah. Right?
Well, I'm saying, like, I love The Princess Diaries. I've watched it enough times now to go, like, I don't think this is actually a very good movie. It's very silly and, like, not always in the best way. But I love it, and I'll defend it. Also, I'm sorry for anyone to bring up his name, but this is another movie that does this for me. The movie Radio Days by Woody Allen. I cannot rightfully tell you that that's a wonderful movie. I can just tell you it feels like chicken soup when I watch it. Like, it just is so comforting. But I don't know if it's, like, a phenomenal film. I just, anytime I watch it, I'm immediately in a good mood, and I feel comforted by it. But, yeah, so, like, within The Heights, when I tell people, like, I liked it, I have problems with it, though, and then when people are like, oh, I loved it, I thought it was amazing, I'm like, I wonder if people could say that they loved it, but they recognized flaws. Because so far, anyone I've spoken to who has said that they loved it have not said that they recognized flaws.
It's sort of a mood thing. That's why I said you have to buy in, and then you get swept up in sort of the noise and the color and the you know, I that's my impression.
Maybe my brain is just too...
It's also, what are your expectations? You know, you have a big splashy movie musical like this in the summer. Do you really expect, you know, everything, every T crossed and every I dotted?
Well, that's, first of all, yes, because...
You're attracted to quality.
Yeah, and guess what movie does do that? That's a feel-good...
Paddington 2.
Paddington 2, you motherfuckers. That movie is perfect. And again, as I said, you cannot like it. Don't want to know you if you don't, but you cannot like it. But there's not a single thing objectively wrong with it. Everything just fits. Everything is thought through. To the point that, like, I don't have to think when I'm watching it. It's so easy for me to buy in because they do all the work for me. I say this about all entertainments. Especially when it's Hollywood and it's Broadway. You're supposed to be the best of the best. And you're supposed to be the tastemakers who are providing the content for all of us. Like, think through it all. And, like, really try to make it the best it can be. If you're going to give us trash, we're going to become used to trash. And, like, we should be wanting to be better. And, like, if we're progressing on a cultural and ethical level as human beings, we should be able to, like, progress our tastes with movies and TV and theater as well, right?
Yeah, you know, I think there is a saying, and I'm not going to get it right, but something like, no one ever went broke underestimating...
H.R. Mencken, I think, was the one who said that. No one, say the full line, I cut you off.
I'm not going to remember the payoff. So, no one ever went broke
underestimating the taste of the American people.
Yeah, that's a taste of the American people. Right?
Yep.
So, you know, you've never worked for a movie studio. They have a big operation to keep going afloat. And so I was at one, I know, where they had to keep putting crap through it because you have people to support with that whole pipeline and they just need something to go through it. So not everything's going to be a gem.
I don't think anything of movie studios. I do not look to them as the tastemakers. I'm referring to the people who make the things. And, like, again, not everything's going to work, but when something's a passion project, when you think, and with someone like Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's, like, whole MO is that he thinks through all the details.
Right.
He doesn't always. I think Hamilton is an objectively better show than In the Heights, just because I think more is thought through and better constructed.
Mm-hmm.
There are songs in the Heights that I prefer to Hamilton, just, like,
right.
I feel more. Like, I feel more listening to Alabanza than I do to It's Quiet Uptown. I get more excited by 96,000 than I do to Skylar Sisters, which is not to be demeaning to Hamilton. It's a testament to how much I like those numbers that I prefer them to some songs in Hamilton. But, alas... Also, like, as I said before, if you're going to be in entertainment, do all the work for me so I can turn off my brain and enjoy you from start to finish. The show that I say does this so well is Mamma Mia. Mamma Mia is so smart about how dumb it is.
It is, right.
Yeah. I mean... Well, because they're like, if we're going to have you buy in to our stupidity, we need to think everything through. And so that way you're never like...
No obstacles.
And you're like, wait, what? Yeah. I mean, the movie of Mamma Mia is a poorly made movie just on a technical level. Like, just where Meryl Streep's on a Greek island, turns the corner, and she's on a soundstage. Just, like, the lighting is so off. Like, it's very clear that Phyllida Lloyd, this was her first movie. But because it follows the stage show pretty well, it's still really enjoyable because the stage show is, you know, bulletproof. It's it it just never fails to entertain.
Right, right.
So final thoughts on In the Heights, Mama.
I am glad that I went to see it on the big screen because, as I said, it was a very different experience. I mean, IMAX takes a bit to get used to because it's so big and in your face, but it helped in this experience, I think.
Concur.
I think it's a nice summer movie. I think that it pays homage to a neighborhood that is continually changing because prior to Latinx population there were Eastern European Jews lived in Washington Heights. And now, as you said, it's getting gentrified with actors and people moving in there. So, you know, I guess it's trying to take a snapshot of a moment in time of a neighborhood. And it really speaks not only to home, but to neighborhood, to community. Yeah. So
I did love that the movie had the story take place around like now. I'm like, the neighborhood's changing. I'm like, honey, the neighborhood's been gentrified for a while.
Yeah.
And I do love that the business that they chose to like be the representation of the gentrification.
Dry cleaner.
A dry cleaner.
Well, it was the price of the dry cleaner.
Yeah.
A Starbucks would have been a better visual.
I think Starbucks would have been easier. I think the dry cleaners, I get why they do it because it's a good way of showing it and not just saying like, okay, with when Abuela goes and he sees the price of how they charge and what it's all going to cost. Like, that's a nice sort of moment where she's like, oh, everything's changing. This is too expensive now. It's just a very specific business to choose to, like, lead the way for gentrification.
And, you know, they weren't really playing on a lot of stereotypes, but I didn't like the fact that the guy who runs the shop or owns the shop read a little bit sort of like late middle-aged Jewish, and so...
Well, he plays Hades in Hadestown, so when I was watching, I'm like, oh, they literally had the guy who plays the devil playing the gentrifier. So that was, like, that was cute to me. But, yeah, no, as I said, I really did like the movie. Go see it in the theater. It didn't do very well this past weekend.
No?
It underperformed at the box office, and granted, we are kind of coming back from COVID, but there were high hopes because A Quiet Place 2 did so well at the box office and In the Heights was so well reviewed and people seemed to be excited for it. And then it underperformed its initial projection.
It might have been overhyped also.
It might have been. But also it's available on HBO Max, so you can watch it there. But apparently it underperformed on there too.
Interesting.
It might become a word of mouth kind of thing because Greatest Showman really kind of bombed its opening weekend and then just sort of maintained. So maybe it'll do that. I would prefer In the Heights to have that narrative over Greatest Showman, as I think In the Heights is a much better movie than Greatest Showman. I will say this to close this out, guys. I know it seems like I was picking on this movie a lot. And to be fair, I do think a lot of things that I said are valid. I did like this movie. I do think it's a good movie. The Greatest Showman, trash. Pure trash. Fucking trash. I'm sorry. It's fucking terrible. And you can have your opinion. You can like The Greatest Showman, but don't you dare look me in my gay little Jewish face and tell me that it's good, because she ain't. She ain't. The Greatest Showman is those 30 seconds of the movie Just Friends where Julie Haggerty sings to Ryan Reynolds off the top of her head, "Be yourself, be yourself." It's that, but it's pop music, and it's circa 1890.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's ugh, ugh, ugh. But go see In the Heights.
Yeah, see In the Heights, and get some popcorn while you're at it.
Yeah. Mama, yes, you're on Instagram now, aren't you?
I am, although I don't really visit it much.
Okay, so no one should try to follow you.
No,
you
they can.
But you don't post anything.
Well, it's only because I've been lazy and I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. But, okay. You know, I can.
Would you want people to friend you on Facebook?
Sure.
Okay. Where can they friend you on Facebook?
Danny Tichton Koplik. I mean, that's what it is.
It's a rainbow photo of a glamorous woman posing. That's my mom. You can find her on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram at Matt Koplik, usual spelling. If you like the podcast, please follow us, rate us or review us. It helps the algorithm. We got some new reviews recently, some new ratings. It's been really nice. Stay tuned for later this week for the final episode of the Sondheim series. Woo, woo, woo. You will also hear my official rankings of the Sondheim musicals.
I just want to give a public service announcement, which is Matt Koplik, my son, should be famous. So keep liking these things.
Oh, God.
Should be famous.
Yeah. Review it. Like it. Tell your friends. Now is the summer to listen to some stuff. And hey, like, if you disagree with me on In the Heights, power to you. by all means, like, send this episode to people who you agree with so they can all send me hateful DMs about how I'm a Lynn hater. Do it. I want to hear it.
You're not a Lynn hater. You praise a lot of his aspects of his work. And
I was very open.
Lyrics and, you know, I mean, yeah.
And again, I liked the movie.
Right.
I did like it. I just did not. I thought I was not as over the moon as other people and was a little baffled by how many people were blind to things that I thought were very obvious flaws. That said, I think to close us out, normally we do a big Broadway diva, but because I just loved her in the movie so much, I think we're going to have Miss Melissa Barrera, the Vanessa of the film, close us out today for this Emma Heights film. Right? Yeah?
Why not? That's good.
I just liked her so much.
Yeah, she was
so
terrific.
Good.
We like her.
Yeah. So check us out later this week and talk to you guys later. Bye.
Awesome. Ciao. The boys are on the way.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.